The PC gave us computing power at home, the internet connected us, and mobile let us do it pretty much anywhere. Now generative AI lets us communicate with technology in our own language using our own senses. But figuring it all out when you're living through it is a totally different story. Welcome to Leading the Shift, a new podcast from Microsoft Azure. I'm your host, Susan Ettlinger. In each episode, leaders will share what they're learning to help you navigate all this change with confidence. Please join us. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Out here, there's no one way of doing things, no unwritten rules, and no shortage of adventure. Because out here, the only requirement is having fun. Bank of America invites kids 6 to 18 to golf with us. For a limited time, sign them up for a free one-year membership, giving them access to discounted tee times at thousands of courses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/golfwithus. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America. Restrictions apply. cbofa.com/golfwithus for complete details. Copyright 2025, Bank of America Corporation.
You know that feeling when someone shows up for you just when you need it most? That's what Uber is all about. Not just a ride or dinner at your door. It's how Uber helps you show up for the moments that matter. Because showing up can turn a tough day around or make a good one even better. Whatever it is, big or small, Uber is on the way. So you can be on yours. Uber, on our way.
At Capella University, you can learn at your own pace with our FlexPath learning format. Take one or two courses at a time and complete as many as you can in a 12-week billing session. With FlexPath, you can even finish the bachelor's degree you started in 22 months for $20,000. A different future is closer than you think with Capella University. Learn more at capella.edu. Fastest 25% of students. Cost varies by pace, transfer credits, and other factors. Fees apply.
Hello, and welcome to Instant Genius, a bite-sized masterclass in podcast form. Every Monday and Friday, you'll hear world-leading scientists and experts talking about the most fascinating ideas in science and technology today. I'm Jason Goodyear, Commissioning Editor at BBC Science Focus. It's commonly believed that the arts and the sciences have little in common with each other. The distinction that's most frequently made is that the arts are creative in nature, whereas the sciences are logical. But this couldn't be further from the truth. In this episode, we catch up with mathematician and author Marcus de Sortoy to talk about his latest book, Blueprints: How Mathematics Shapes Creativity. He tells us how, fundamentally, mathematics is the study of patterns, structure, and symmetry, how these patterns are found everywhere in music, visual art, and architecture, and why we should be teaching students how to spot them in their everyday lives. So welcome to the podcast. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So today we're talking about your book, Blueprints: How Mathematics Shapes Creativity. So let's start with the sort of big overarching question. I mean, there's a sort of common idea that science and maths are separate from art, maybe perpetuated by lots of things like the left brain, right brain myth. And personally, this is something that's always really confused me, because I think pure mathematicians and theoretical physicists are some of the most free-thinking, creative people that we have in the world. So where do you think this idea comes from?
Yes, I think it's the idea that we're after some sort of fundamental truths, and somehow you can't be creative, that you're being boxed in by this attempt to kind of just explain the universe around us. But actually, to come up with these solutions that mathematics and physics and science more generally has arrived at requires a lot of imagination, creativity, leaps into the unknown. And I think on the counter side, you see, I think that many people feel like artists are so free, they can do anything. And actually, that's not true. And most artists talk about the necessity of having constraints to, in order to kind of frame their creativity. So for example, Stravinsky always used to say, I can only be creative under huge constraints. And very often those constraints are, you know, structures that they put on themselves, within which they then duck and weave and find kind of their creativity, but through these constraints. I think the blank page, you see, is just terrifying. But if you put some sort of structure on that blank page, then it kind of guides you into new realms that you may not have thought about. Now, I think this is really the thesis of my book in a way, is that the connection, therefore, between the creative arts and in particular mathematics is this idea of structure. Structures are absolutely fundamental to what any architect or a composer is doing. But I would define mathematics as the study of structure. You see, I think most people think that mathematics is all about arithmetic and long division to lots of decimal places. But that's like saying that music is just about scales and arpeggios. Yeah, they are somehow some of the ingredients for what we make. But actually, you know, I don't do very much sort of arithmetic in my day-to-day life as a mathematician. What I'm interested in is understanding and exploring the possibility of new structures.
Yeah, so these days we have calculators and computers for the donkey work, don't we?
Yeah, exactly. And that never really was what mathematics was about for me. I mean, I think, you know, I would say that we have this kind of misconception about mathematics because mathematics is all about the kind of technical utilitarian ideas about helping you to fill in your tax form and things like that. And, you know, I kind of wish that we had in our education system almost two mathematics courses. One is the kind of mathematical literacy, you know, like English literature. But then we do English language in our schools and we learn about Shakespeare and romantic poetry and George Orwell. And I somehow wish we had a kind of mathematics literature course where we could explore some of these kind of big ideas of infinity or geometries beyond our three-dimensional world, things which really have stimulated a lot of creative artists when they've encountered these. I mean, if you take someone like Borges, a wonderful Argentinian writer, you know, he got exposed to ideas of infinity, of geometries beyond our three dimensions, sort of, and these were somehow the catalyst for some of his wonderful short stories. He didn't really understand the mathematics, but he wanted to use his own language, which is the language of storytelling, to explore these mind-blowing ideas. So I sort of somehow think we're cheating our students at school of these wonderful, beautiful mathematical structures, which often are the catalyst for many creative artists.
I completely agree. I thought an overarching theme of the book was that mathematics really, in essence, is the language of nature.
Exactly. And that's, in a sense, where the connection is, because I would say creative artists, you see, are using their language to interpret the natural world around them. Very often, if you take somebody like Jackson Pollock, his drip paintings are actually a response to the kind of the natural world around him, and he represented it in this abstract form. But what he understands intuitively is that he arrives at sort of geometric structures in his artwork that I recognize as a mathematician, which is the idea of fractals. And fractals are, of course, how nature grows things. This kind of idea of a simple algorithm, which if you keep on repeating it, gives rise to huge complexity. So there's, I would say, the blueprint or the shape that's behind my book is the idea of a triangle with nature at one corner and then mathematics and the creative arts at the other two corners, and that we're both responding to the natural world around us, but we find our own different languages to do that. Maybe it's the language of music, the language of visuals or poetry or mathematics. But that's why I feel like we're inevitably going to be interested in similar sorts of structures, because they very often have their common root in nature.
So you mentioned music there. So let's kick off with that, because that's one of my jams. It's just absolutely bound up in mathematics and physics. So I think a lot of people don't know, like you have the fifth interval, boom, boom. And you talk a lot in the book about circles. So a lot of people that have studied music will know the circle of fifths, you know, we C, G, D, A, whatever. But this is really, really interesting, because our tuning system isn't correct mathematically. It's not the 3-to-2 ratio. You know, like, what can we say about that? Like, it goes all the way back to Pythagoras.
Yes. I mean, the beginning is the kind of discovery that music is at its heart incredibly mathematical. And that's what Pythagoras discovered, that, you know, why do we find this thing that we call a perfect fifth, which you sang so beautifully, you know, so harmonic? And this is universal across the globe. I mean, it's not just something specific to Western music. Indian music is still based on this perfect fifth as being somehow the seed of harmony. And this is the beautiful thing, you know, why do we divide our scale? If you, anyone's got a piano at home, you'll see that there are 12 notes which repeat themselves. Why is 12 the division that we make of the kind of the octave? Why didn't we go decimal? Why didn't we do 10 notes when we introduced metric? It's because, as you say, this interesting thing about a circle, which we call the cycle of fifths. We produce this two harmonic notes, which are in this 3-2 relationship. And this is what Pythagoras discovered, that beautiful harmonic pair. If you take a guitar string and you'd play sort of half the length and the third the length, you get this pair, which is very harmonic. So what our ear is responding to, we're aesthetically being drawn to something with these beautiful mathematical relationship. But then if you then take this, you know, the top note of that first pair and make that the bottom note of a new pair, and you keep on doing this and you're producing more and more notes. Now, it could go on forever, but rather magically, after 12 notes, we seem to get back to almost the note we started with. It's 7 octaves higher, and so it seems to come in some sort of full circle. And that those 12 notes that we produce, if we kept on going, we'd could just get another 12 similar notes of just octave difference. So that's the reason that across the globe, we find the octave, which is in a 1-2 relationship, being divided up into these 12 notes. But as you say, it isn't actually exact. And there's this wonderful tension between, yeah, it's not quite joining up. And that difference is actually was the beginning of a lot of headaches about how to tune a piano such you can change, you know, from one scale to another. And I suppose that's also something quite interesting, a tension which arises in the book, which is this tension between the beautiful abstract world of mathematics and the physical realization of it. So even the circle, which is a very simple thing to define mathematically, its beginning of Euclid's Elements is almost the building block of geometry, a curve which is an equal distance from a fixed point. But is there physically anywhere in the universe a true circle? And quantum physics says actually, well, hold on, but our whole world is pixelated. If you go down to a particular, you know, magnification, everything becomes little pixels. And therefore, we can't have this kind of perfect idea of a circle. At some point, we suddenly see the pixelization and it isn't exact. So in a weird way, there's always this tension between the abstract sort of beautiful world of mathematics and the rather messy physicalization of it in the natural world around us.
So let's stick with music for a moment, because you talk in the book a lot about Bach, specifically the Goldberg Variations, which is one of my favorite pieces. I watched Víkingur Ólafsson play it last month, in fact. And we've talked about the circular notion of notes or scales, but how about the circular notion of composition?
Yes, I think this is really important, because I think, you know, there's a obvious connection between mathematics and music on this kind of harmonic level and rhythmic level as well. You see a lot of numbers being used to create interesting rhythmic structures. But I think what we're missing very often is that there's mathematical structure in the way that composers put these ingredients together to make a piece. And Bach is the perfect example. And I've done a lot of events with pianists about the Goldberg Variations, because there's just so much beautiful structure in there. So, you know, the Goldberg Variation starts with this beautiful aria, then it goes on this incredible journey of 30 variations, and then comes back to the aria at the end. And so you've already got this idea of something coming full circle, and almost like, are we starting again? And even if you look at the 16th variation, which is halfway through this circle, Bach calls this an overture, which is generally the beginning of a piece. So Bach's almost teasing us that, you know, where is the beginning of a circle? Actually, a circle doesn't have a beginning. But then you get another kind of structural circle appearing in the canons. So every third variation is a canon, where people probably remember this from school, where you start, half the class starts singing, and then a little later, the second half joins in with the same tune, but delayed in time. So Bach loves the idea of a canon, but he really plays with this idea that, well, you could get the second voice coming in, perhaps a note higher. And so each canon through the variations, it isn't just a simple repetition. It's a repetition, but a movement in pitch as well. So gradually, as you go through each canon, you hear the second voice starting higher and higher and higher until the eighth canon, you get this kind of joining up because we hit the octave. And the octave is something which sounds almost like the beginning again. It's higher, but yet sounds the same, and so we give it the same name in our musical notation. And so we get this, within this circle, we get another circle, which is a kind of harmonic or pitch circle. So I like to think that the Goldberg Variations almost has the structure of a circle's worth of circles, which in mathematics we call a torus. If you move a circle around a circle, you get the idea of a torus. So there are lots of games, and also the variations themselves. Bach is using ideas of another important blueprint that I talk about in the book, which is the idea of symmetry. So symmetry allows you to take a shape and then move it in some way, such that it's related to what you started with, but somehow different. And so we see Bach doing this in the variations. You'll have the first theme racing upwards, and then he'll reflect that in the horizontal line, and you'll hear the same theme but descended going downwards. It's the same theme but reflected in some way. So Bach was a master at using the kind of ideas of symmetry as a kind of algorithm for generating kind of complexity within music using simple ingredients.
For maybe people who don't know much about music, essentially what we're saying there is mathematics, geometry, symmetry is absolutely everywhere. It's absolutely ingrained in us.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what the brain is doing when we're listening to music and how we distinguish music from, say, noise is the idea of some structure that we can, a pattern that we are recognizing within that structure. And I suppose that's another definition I might give of mathematics, that it's the science of patterns. Patterns, you know, we're a pattern searcher. So I think that's one thing where, you know, the brain is constantly trying to find patterns in the kind of chaotic world around us. And, you know, even it's how we survived in an evolutionary way. Those who understood pattern and structure and symmetry were the ones who survived in this world. So the brain is somehow tuned to try and pull out pattern, whatever it's listening to or watching or reading. And those patterns are often very mathematical in nature.
When you think about super successful businesses that are selling through the roof, like Heinz or Mattel, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But there's a secret. The business behind the business making selling simple for them and buying simple for their customers. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout as Heinz and Mattel. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/promo, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/promo to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/promo.
Spring savings are in the air, and at Ross, where they have savings on all the brands you love. From the latest fashion to outdoor decor and even pet supplies, savings are in every aisle. Go to Ross and save 20 to 60% off other retailers' prices on your favorite spring finds.
As a contractor, I don't pay for materials I don't use. So why would I pay for stuff I don't need in my mobile plan? That's why the new My Biz plan from Verizon Business is so perfect. Now I can choose exactly what I want, and I only pay for what I need.
Right now, with My Biz plan, get our best price, as low as $25 a line. Visit Verizon.com/business to get started today.
Price per month with 5+ lines. Includes auto pay and paper-free billing and special intro offer discounts. Taxes, fees, economic adjustment charge, and terms apply. Offers end June 10th, 2025.
So let's move on to visual art then. So I think a lot of people will have heard, it's on the cover of your book, the golden ratio. So what can we say about that?
Yeah, the golden ratio is probably the fundamental kind of mathematical structure which we see the artist being drawn to time and again, because it's a kind of ratio of two lengths. For example, you can define it in this way. If you have a rectangle where the long side of the rectangle, the ratio of that to the short side is the same as the ratio of the sum of the two sides to the long side. This is a rectangle we call in the golden ratio. And this seems to be something that we're aesthetically drawn to time and again, both visually and actually orally as well. There are some wonderful examples of composers like Debussy or Bartok or even Mozart using this kind of ratio in their pieces, such that the sort of climax of a piece will come at the golden ratio distance from the beginning to the end. But visually, we see this, for example, especially in someone like Leonardo da Vinci. He loves using this proportion. And I think very knowingly, in the case of Leonardo, he was very much trained as a mathematician as well as an artist. You know, I think this is the moment, you know, where we see these two disciplines really fusing together in such an exciting way. And, you know, since then, we've seen kind of art and science somehow separating, but in this period in the Renaissance, they're really overlapping, and you see Leonardo working alongside mathematicians and artists creating the idea of perspective and things. But there's something rather magical about the golden ratio, which is it kind of focuses our attention not on the center of the rectangle, but sort of four different regions where you get a kind of spiral. There's a very natural way to build a spiral into a golden ratio, because if you take a square out of that rectangle, whose dimensions are the sort of shorter side, the rectangle that remains, a smaller rectangle, is again in the golden ratio. And if you take a square out of that, you then get a smaller rectangle, which is again golden ratio. So there's something very nice about this, because if you keep on dividing this shape, it somehow replicates itself at smaller and smaller scale. And this is something, for example, that Le Corbusier was drawn to, an architect who loved using the idea of the golden ratio in the proportions of his buildings, because he loved the idea that somehow you could take out a square out of the dimensions of a building or a room, and the dimensions that were left would be the same ratio, but scaled down from the original thing. So he found that very attractive. And I think the key thing here is that the golden ratio is something we see time and again appearing, not just in art, but in nature. So nature uses the golden ratio and somehow some fundamental numbers called the Fibonacci numbers, which are very much related to the golden ratio, in the way that it builds things. And so when we see shapes in the golden ratio or build out of these things called the Fibonacci numbers, we're actually responding to them kind of positively, I think, because they are resonating with things in the natural world. And those are always things we that some sense gives us a sense of, you know, pleasure and happiness, and because responding to the natural world is something that we've been doing ever since we've evolved as a species.
So you mentioned the Fibonacci numbers. So let's have a look at that. So first off, there, once you know them, they're everywhere, like petals and flowers, et cetera, et cetera. But what exactly are they?
Yeah, so they're a sequence of numbers which starts 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13. And maybe you've spotted a pattern about how to get the next one, because what you do is you add 8 and 13 to get 21. And so these have a natural sense of growth in them. You take the two previous numbers in the sequence to get the next number along. And this is why we see them somehow in the way nature grows things, because nature needs to use what it's made before in order to make its next step. And so, for example, as you mentioned, petals on flowers invariably are Fibonacci numbers. But the lovely thing is, so Fibonacci, who are they named after? An Italian mathematician of the 12th, 13th century, who discovered this idea that they are all over the natural world. But what I love is that they were originally discovered not by mathematicians or scientists, but by musicians and poets. So the poets and musicians in India several centuries earlier are interested in creating interesting rhythm patterns, especially, say, a tabla player who is, you know, knocking out rhythms, long and short beats, and wants to show off and produce as many interesting rhythms as possible out of these combinations of long and short beats. And as they discovered, you know, the way to build these rhythms, all the different possibilities, it turns out it's the Fibonacci numbers and this idea of using the kind of two previous sets of rhythms to make the next rhythms along is why Indian musicians And poets should really be credited with the discovery of these numbers as a way to generate interesting kind of rhythmic structures. So probably they should be called the Hemachandra numbers rather than the Fibonacci numbers. But I think there's something really important here because, you know, I think often we think, oh yeah, of course, the mathematicians discover these structures first, and then maybe the musicians kind of plunder the cabinet of wonders that we have. But that's not true. Very often we see musicians being drawn to these structures for their aesthetic value. And then we mathematicians recognize them perhaps at a later stage as important kind of ingredients for making the natural world around us. So again, it's, you know, there's a real sort of dialogue going on between the mathematicians and the creative artists and nature in discovering these structures.
I think that's a really important point because a lot of people will think like where they study maths at school, or what's the point in this? What am I going to do with it? But It all comes from nature, and it's a way that we can understand the things around us, you know, and that's very important. And like you say, I mean, it's not taught in that way, like you say, English language, English literature, and that's a crying shame to me.
I agree. I think that as soon as you show somebody that nature is doing mathematics, you realize this thing is of fundamental importance. And I think, you know, one of the tragedies is that we focus too much on utility in our education system and less on just enjoying the beauty of what we have around us. And, you know, I think, you see, understanding these structures allows you to build such interesting new things. I mean, I think that's, you know, where mathematics appears is first understanding the natural world, but then perhaps making sort of the human world around us. So the idea of, you know, if we go back 5,000 years to the ancient Egyptians, the pyramids, to be able to build a pyramid, you have to understand something about the geometry of that shape. But once you do, you have the power to create something really stunning, which, you know, is a mark of human creativity.
So how do you think, sort of overridingly, how does mathematics and aesthetics, how do they correspond, I suppose I'd say?
Yes, I mean, we do talk a lot about beauty in mathematics and it being an important quality of discovering truth, actually. You know, I mean, Keats always talked about this connection between truth and beauty. And maybe, you know, aesthetics, where does aesthetics come from? It probably comes from a kind of evolutionary value that's having a kind of aesthetic response to something, a feeling of beauty is probably connected to an understanding of the natural world around us. So probably the structures that we find interesting mathematically and those that we're drawn to from an artistic sense and we call maybe beautiful or interesting or surprising are those which have helped us to navigate and understand our place in the natural world around us. But, you know, beauty and aesthetics isn't everything. I mean, sometimes there's something quite nice about the gritty nature of something which isn't necessarily so beautiful. So one of the interesting kind of blueprints I talked about, structures towards the end, is the idea of randomness, which is actually, you might think, is kind of like an anti-structure, an anti-blueprint, almost going against that sense of wanting to make something with structure. But again, you know, randomness is an important part of the natural world around us. We see maybe a kind of simple algorithm helping us to grow the things in the garden, but the influence of the weather will introduce an element of randomness, which means that everything doesn't look, you know, like a computer generated. And so introducing that idea of randomness, it's a key part of the natural world, and it's a key part of many artistic disciplines, is introducing the role of kind of randomness, you know, whether it's in writing or visuals or music, does send you off in an interesting direction. But randomness itself has kind of structural elements, and that's why we do have something called the mathematics of randomness, which allows us to navigate our way through a world full of risk and chance and uncertainty.
Yeah, so this is really interesting. So people throw around the word random all the time. But, you know, what does it actually mean?
Yes, it's a very good question. I mean, we could do a whole podcast connected to, you know, is there anything truly random? Because in general, randomness is more a measure of our lack of knowledge of a situation. If you think about how a dice rolls, if we had all the parameters precisely, then we'd probably be able to use Newton's equations of motion to predict how the dice will land. But that's the point. We discovered in the beginning of the 20th century this idea of chaos theory, where even if something does have a set of equations which are controlling it, a small perturbation can send it off in a completely different direction. And so, you know, I think that's one of the other interesting ingredients that artists use is setting up still something with rules, but something which is essentially chaotic in nature, and that a small perturbation can send the thing off in a completely different direction. And that's quite exciting. Sort of it's that tension between something which has a rule yet is still unpredictable. You probably have to go to really down to the fundamental particles of nature to see something which we believe is genuinely random, which is quantum physics says that essentially the world is random in nature, that and there is no determinism in where you will find an electron. It is just probabilistic in nature.
So we've talked about an awful lot there. I don't know. Personally, I'd like to get people enthusiastic about maths. Anyone listening, you know, how can we do that?
I think that understanding that things you are passionate about and love, for example, you're passionate about music or the visual world or maybe poetry or literature, what I'm hoping this book will do is to illustrate that behind many of the things you love are these interesting mathematical structures. Even something like Shakespeare. You know, Shakespeare, you think, is a wordsmith, but also loved to use number to create certain effects. So, you know, we know things come in tens in Shakespeare, iambic pentameter, but actually the most famous line in Shakespeare, to be or not to be, that is the question, is 11 syllables, a prime number. It's something which disrupts you. It sends you out of that sense of complacency and rhythm, because Shakespeare wants to indicate something that you should be alert to. And whenever there's magic in Shakespeare, he goes down to 7 syllables. So you can understand that something magical is afoot through the numbers. So for me, those people who perhaps wouldn't normally think of themselves as interested in mathematics, if they understand that there are mathematical structures at work in the things that they love, in particular, that they might be structures that will help them in their own creativity, then I think that's the key to them being interested to explore this beautiful world of mathematics.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Instant Genius, brought to you from the team behind BBC Science Focus. That was Marcus de Sautoy. To discover more about the topics we've just discussed, check out his book, Blueprints: How Mathematics Shapes Creativity. If you liked what you just heard, then please do consider subscribing to Instant Genius on your preferred podcast platform. If you'd like to see our guests and presenters in person, then please also check out our YouTube channel, at Science Focus. The current issue of BBC's Science Focus magazine is out now. Pick up a copy wherever you buy your favourite magazines, or download us on your app store of choice. You can also find us on Apple News or online at sciencefocus.com.
Now at Verizon, we're locking in low prices for 3 years guaranteed on my plan. And you can get a single line for just $45 a month when you switch and bring your phone. That's our best price ever on unlimited welcome with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Guaranteed for 3 years. Because at Verizon, we got you. Visit your local San Jose Verizon store today.
$20 monthly promo credits apply over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Price guarantee applies to then current base monthly rate. Additional terms and conditions apply.